So the problem I will talk a little bit about is largely unsolved. So I more talk about formulation of the problem than the solution, because I don't know the solution. Usually in ADS CFT, in particular in ADS 5 CFT4, we are concerned with the limit when the radius of ADS space is very large. This is because it's supposed to work at all radii perhaps, but the supergravity description of string theory is valid only when the radius of ADS space is very large, and when the radius is small, we don't have much control because we don't understand the Wolfshit sigma model very well. So perhaps in order to gain some understanding of the Wolfshit sigma model, it would be nice to understand the opposite limit when the radius of ADS space is very small. And in fact, there is a hope that we can understand it from looking from precisely the ADS CFT correspondence, because the boundary S matrix becomes, in this limit, the correlation functions of the free field theory. And therefore, we know the boundary S matrix exactly. And perhaps from knowing the boundary S matrix, we could understand the string dynamics. So as far as I understand, this idea first appeared in print in this paper by Hagemani and Sandborg. They suggested to study the string theory by looking at the boundaries, but by looking at the correlation functions in the free field theory. So what can we say? First of all, we know exactly the spectrum of primary fields on the boundary, and the general ADS CFT logic tells us that primary fields on the boundary should correspond to fields in the bulk. So this means that we know the field content in this bulk theory.
So I'm going to ask you before you switch that paper, Hagemann and Sandborg, I mean, what do they do? Do they use the boundary S matrix to calculate things? I mean, do they?
I would say that, in my opinion, they first noticed that there is a very non that there is non-trivial quantity which is 1/n correction to the endpoint correlation functions on the boundary. Well, to
oh, so they're approaching it from the direction still of large curvature, or no?
Well, they just written down the correlation functions in the free theory, and noticed that although the theory is free, it has very non-trivial correlation functions, all these rational functions coming from weak contractions. And it would be nice to understand, to reproduce them from ADS. And also they noticed mentioned various interesting things like existence of multigravitons in this theory, because there are several operators with twist 2 on the boundary. So they mentioned that in the bulk there should be several gravitons. So they first posed the question of of finding classical theory. So the parameter n, we know the spectrum of primaries, and we know that this is SUN theory on the boundary. So when n equals to infinity, then the correlation function in the boundary factorizes. Consider 2n point correlation functions, it factorizes into n 2-point correlation functions. And therefore, from the bulk point of view, it would mean that just the fields which correspond to primaries would propagate freely without interactions. But turning on the small 1/n would correspond to turning on interactions in the bulk. For example, consider the endpoint correlation functions of traces phi square. There are the scalars in mu, so we consider trace of square with scalar, and we consider endpoint correlation functions. There is 1/n in front of trace coming from the normalization of the 2-point function. And then, of course, there is extra power of n square coming from the trace, the overall trace. So this is the leading connected contribution to. This is some rational function, very non-trivial, and we can try to reproduce it from vertices in the bulk. And we see that 1 over n is the coupling constant. Because for tree diagrams, if you say that triple vertices come with 1 over n, quartic vertices come on 1 over n squared, etc., then that would be the correct for endpoint tree diagram. Yes, so here I written just three-point function, and we need to find the interaction vertex. It's so it seems to me that it should not be a problem to find some theory with interacting fields which would reproduce the free field correlators on the boundary, but this is too vague problem. It would have too many solutions, perhaps. But if we require that the interactions are local, then this would perhaps have only one solution.
I'm getting confused. Doesn't supergravity reproduce this?
Supergravity does not. Well, supergravity in particular reproduces, yes, three-point functions of trace phi square. But for four-point functions of trace phi square, it doesn't. Yeah. It indeed reproduces the three point, and I will talk a little bit about it. But yes, so
3 points are dictated by conformal.
Well, yeah.
I mean, three point is the same.
Exactly.
Up to a function of any order.
Yeah, I don't know any argument from string theory which would say that in this classical theory the interaction vertex will be local. So it should be considered as a working hypothesis, because without this assumption, I don't know how to formulate the problem very well.
Why would you expect it to? I mean, the duality is with string theory.
Uh-huh.
This is not the local limit of string theory.
Well, this is not the local, but we want to say that non-locality boils into the fact that there are infinitely many intermediate states.
But are full strings worth?
Well, this is presumably, see, in this free theory on the boundary, there are many vector primaries or tensor primaries with arbitrary spin. Mm-hmm. So that would correspond to, that's why it's called high spin theory, because we know that there are high spin primaries on the boundary, so there should be high spin fields in the bulk. And so here, massless, yes. Well, I will talk a little bit about masslessness. So there would be infinitely many intermediate states here.
But not as many as string theory.
Well, I don't know how many in string theory in the limit alpha prime goes to infinity. So I don't know how to have insight into this. Also, there are, I will talk a little bit. This, we can truncate in a number of ways this theory. Presumably, the full string theory would have also massive states. But I think you can truncate to the massless sector. Anyway, the statement is that perhaps from the three-point function, you can read the triple interactions. And then you can sum over all intermediate channels over all the higher spins, and then subtract it and see that the only remaining thing will be reproduced by local interaction.
Wait, sorry. Maybe why local?
This is, I don't know. No, this is a question whether it's possible to do in a local interaction or not. I don't know any.
But this is not at low energy.
Well, this is high energy, yes.
So, from the point of view of string theory, it's pretty bizarre.
Well, in string theory, I would say that we can introduce effective radius of interaction, if you wish, the size of the interaction. And I would find it improbable that the size of interaction would be of the order of ADS size.
Well, but a string is bigger than your whole trans, bigger than the entire room in this limit.
Yes.
So I'm not sure, I mean, why
thing should be local. There's local world sheet theory, but you're talking now about local space-time.
Yes. I don't know the good reason for this to be local, but if it is...
Isn't the structure of closed Stankill theory? You get three or you have additional orthogonal curves.
Is that local in the midpoint? Is that...
Sorry? We're saying that this is a structure of closed Stankill theory, which you have three bounds, and then you have additional orthogonal curves.
Yeah, local.
At John Schwartz's birthday, people were at a survey they were local,
yes.
And the audience was very hard on him.
Yeah.
No answer, I think.
Yes.
But the claim is there is a local theory that you're going to tell us about. So.
Well, no.
He's trying to construct a local.
Yes. This is a claim of Vasiliev, but I wasn't able so far to verify it.
That there, well, his claim is that there is a local theory in the bulk.
Well, he constructed some interacting theory. I don't think, well, I'm not sure if he explicitly claims that it is local, but I think that this is the only formulation of the problem which is interesting because, yes. But it's not clear if you write, he writes interactions in some implicit way. Mm-hmm. It's not obvious for me that if you write them explicitly, they will be local.
Very hard to write a non-local.
That is already hard, but this problem is too vague. It's like it's hard to give a concrete example of something which would reproduce the right correlation functions. But clearly, we know that there are many such examples.
But in order to do this, presumably, you need not just, you need all the operators on the outside.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but there is some slight simplification, first of all. Well, there are some, well, not exactly all, but, yeah. So let me tell about some hints of how this would happen. Well, first of all, there are this notation that I like to think about ADS spaces hyperboloid in the six-dimensional space. And the boundary of hyperboloid is the space of light rays, the base of the light cone. I wanted first to draw it yellow, but then I realized that it would be invisible, so sorry about that. So the operators of conformal dimension delta, for example, scalar operators on the boundary of conformal dimension delta would correspond to fields with mass square given by this relation. And we can write very easily the expression for the boundary to bulk propagator. So the boundary is a space of light rays. We represent it as a light-like vector, L. And the point inside is a vector with length square 1. So the boundary to bulk propagator is 1 over V dot L to the power dimension. One can see that it satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation with this mass square. For example, for trace phi square, the conformal dimension equals 2. So the boundary to bulk will be just 1 over V dot L square. And the interesting identity I want to remind you about, derived essentially in this paper by Tucker, Friedman, and Rastelli, is that if you consider, the paper was called How to Compute Z-Integrals Without Really Trying. So Z-integral is this is two boundary to bulk propagator, and this is bulk to bulk propagator. And the integral is over the position of interaction. So after you compute this is a scalar bulk to bulk propagator, what you get is the product of the actually boundary-to-boundary propagator, which is just the propagator of the free scalar field phi in the free theory on the boundary. In this notation, it will be 1 over the product of the corresponding light-like vectors. If you go to Poincaré coordinates, it will be 1 over x1 minus x2 square. It is this factor. Times 1 over v dot l1, v dot l2. So these two factors are propagators. Could be, so in some sense, as propagators of delta equals 1 fields inside, which would naively be the fields corresponding to the operator of conformal dimension 1, which would be phi. So this is a very nice formula. And of course, what we want to do it is somehow perhaps iterate this formula by opening all these vertices into triangles and considering and then reducing finally the diagram, which was essentially the diagram was like this, and then we would reduce it to diagram like this. But I don't know how explicitly to do it. It's just a suggestive formula. So this formula tells that the three-point, why the three-point function are correctly reproduced, because the three-point function, this interaction vertex, is when and when V approaches to the boundary, so we have just the product of three bulk-to-bulk propagators. But for four-point functions, it cannot work. For four-point function, it cannot work, and there is, in fact, obvious obstacle. And the obvious obstacle is that the double trace operator will get anomalous dimension, which could never happen in the free theory. The reason is very easy to see from if you take only scalar field in the intermediate channel. So if you consider this diagram and we introduce the free part of this diagram gives some function phi of v. We introduce the free part of phi which satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation and the part which is orthogonal to all the solution of Klein-Gordon equation. And we know that this diagram becomes infinite singular when when L1 approaches to L2, but all the singularity is in phi naught, because the singularity is due to the divergence of the integral when the interaction point is near the boundary. So phi 1 is finite. The boundary interpretation is that phi naught corresponds to contribution of trace phi square to the operator product expansion of 2 trace phi square, and phi 1 corresponds to double trace operator. So just on dimensional ground, we can see that phi 1 is 1 over v dot l to the power 4, where l is in the limit when l1 goes to l2 goes to l. Then the resulting integral in this limit becomes, so we have 1 over v over l to the fourth from this couple and 1 over v to the l prime fourth from these 2 points. So the resulting integral becomes logarithmically divergent, and this logarithmic divergence indicates that there is a log L1 minus L1 dot L2 squared term when L1 goes to L2. This means that this diagram cannot possibly be given by the rational function. This log is the coefficient of the log is the anomalous dimension of this operator. So what should happen is when we consider higher spins here, so when we add all the higher spins here and sum the divergences, the coefficient of divergence should cancel among high spin field somehow.
Andre, these pictures on the right are supposed to those are supposed to represent the phi's, the free phi's in the operator trace phi squared. I mean, that's like a field theory calculation, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, the phi's really kind of live on the boundary. They're in the field theory, but somehow the idea that there's a bulk propagator which whose boundary to boundary bit is the same as the boundary theory propagator.
You're asking whether I can find field in the bulk corresponding to phi.
Your lines are drawn through the bulk. Maybe I should keep, but they really feel very little.
And that the first picture you have there, the right-hand side, the circle with the triangle.
This is the boundary of ADS. No. Blue is
upper right. What's that picture?
That's a picture.
Yes. No. Yeah. No. Yeah.
Oh, everything in the boundary. Okay. Good.
Everything on the boundary. Yeah. I don't know how to make sense of field.
And this also works for more than trace phi squared. Like with trace phi to the nth, it works, doesn't it, too, where you have multiple propagators going from point to point?
No, this would not work. And I explained that it cannot work because this function is clearly not a rational function.
Not only with 4, I mean, 3 points with higher operators. There are also agreements. I mean, things also work agree there, don't they? 2-point functions or 3-point functions.
For high spin operators?
I thought that there were a whole bunch of all the chiral. Yeah, only chiral. But there's lots of chiral operators, trace phi to the nth.
For trace phi to the nth, we know that it works, yes.
So there's more identities than just this one that work.
Well, this identity is very easy to derive because we know that if we consider this integral, 1 this d of vw, 1 over w to the L1, w L2, then the Laplace operator on this should be equal to this, w L1 square, w, v L1 square, v L2 square. Mm-hmm. And what I've written is just the obvious solution, 1 over L1 dot L2 times 1 over v dot L1, 1 over v dot L2. This is the obvious solution of Laplace, this equals this. And if we consider higher operators, then I would say that just the power would be higher.
Okay, okay.
And obviously there are lots of identities like this. So that's, I think, how it would work. And separately, we know, of course, that these correlation functions are correctly reproduced from the point of Minvolo, Zyberg, von Lee, and Rangamani. Here is another suggestive formula. This is actually mine. We take the one contribution to the boundary correlator, which we know on the boundary, and by various tricks we can find it. We can represent it as the integral over some non-local interaction in the bulk. So we have the sum over nth derivative acting on here v dot L1, v dot L2, etc. Here are the propagators of the field from the boundary to the bulk of delta equals 2. And here is some very non-local vertex, which has summation over infinite number of derivatives. So perhaps one should think of this infinite number of derivatives as the result of integrating out the higher spin field.
How does this
arise? What?
How does this arise?
Oh, well, there are various tricks for integrating over there. Yeah, you have to write down the integrals and use the.
But this infinite sum.
Yeah. Then. But I don't know how to really use this formula because I don't. So it would be nice to represent it as the sum over intermediate interactions with integrating out.
Say each one of those looks like a vertex of a higher spin?
I would say, I don't know. I would say that when you integrate out these intermediate fields, you should get something like this. Don't know how this would happen. So I don't know how to use this formula. And so I have tried originally to just try to guess what would be interaction in the bulk, which would reproduce the right correlation functions on the boundary, but I think it's very hard. So I came to the conclusion that this is not the right way of doing it. And I think now that the right way of doing it is using the formulas, using the symmetries of the Severi on the boundary. And so that the idea is that the Severi on the boundary should have infinitely many symmetries, and one of them is just Poincaré symmetry. But on free Severi, we can consider the variation of the fields with more derivatives. And then if we had odd number of derivatives, then the action will be still invariant because we integrate by parts odd number of times. So we should look at the Severi in the bulk, which have the same group of symmetries, but here they are global symmetries, and we have to look for the Severi in the bulk, which have them as gauge symmetries. There is one more thought here, which is that if we really believe that Severi on the bulk corresponds to some Severi on the boundary, free Severi on the boundary corresponds to some interacting Severi in the bulk, then this interacting Severi in the bulk should perhaps have consistent truncation. Namely, consider the subset of operators on the boundary, which are bilinears in the free fields, bilinears in the free fields. Then this subset of operators has an interesting property that it is closed under the operator product expansion. And from I think from the bulk theory, this implies that, so it's not rigorous, but it most probably implies that the bulk theory would have a consistent truncation on only those fields which are, which correspond to primary operators which are bilinears in free fields, because there are many other primary operators which have higher powers of free fields. But I think that the primary operators which are bilinears would be a consistent truncation. And of course, this theory would contain all the currents generating the symmetries, because the currents are bilinear in fields. Moreover, traces of phi square, actually, traces of bilinears and scalars would also be closed under the operator product expansion, which suggests that we can restrict ourselves to the scalar theory on the boundary. And already for the theory of scalars on the boundary, there should be something in the bulk which gives correlation functions. And of course, it is now I should cite this papers by Vasiliev, because he claims that perhaps he solved this problem. With Fratkin. The problem was of finding the interaction high spin theory with the right group of symmetries was actually formulated by Fronsdal in 1978. And very long ago, the people haven't possibly thought about ADS-CFT correspondence at that time, but the problem was formulated then. And there was progress in these papers by Fratkin and Vasiliev, but I'm not ready to talk about it. And in fact, I hope that we will have Vasiliev here to talk about it. So what I will do instead is I will talk about this higher spin symmetries and more talk about formulation of the problem. So the plan of the remaining part will be, I will first explain what are these bilinear operators which generate the conserved, the higher spin symmetries in the free field theory, and what is the algebraic structure of the higher spin symmetries, which algebra they form. Then I will explain about free higher spin fields in ADS and what is the n equals to infinity ADS-CFT correspondence, why free higher spin fields correspond to primary operators on the boundary. And massless higher spin fields correspond, of course, to the operators on the boundary which have twist 2. And then I will briefly talk about the relation between global symmetries on the boundary and the gauge symmetries in the bulk. So what do we want from the theory in the bulk, which would give us the theory with the right symmetries on the boundary?
Excuse me. Why are we still talking about ADS? I mean, we've sort of taken a limit where the ADS curvature is much bigger than the string scale. Right? So it's not clear that, you know, the geometry is still ADS.
This is the same question as why the interaction is local. Because we need some kind of ADS because we want interaction to be local. Because we want conformal symmetry. ADS comes from conformal symmetry, but of course, ADS would come from locality of, well, obviously, yeah. Reconstruction of space-time. We will consider, there are six scalars in Young-Mills, but we consider a single complex scalar field because it's essentially just the simplest notations. What I'm going to say first would be true about any number of dimensions. This theory in any number of dimensions is conformally invariant. It's invariant under Poincaré, of course, dilatations, and also it has the special conformal transformations on phi. Now, the primary operators are those which are annihilated by the special conformal transformations. We can write an ansatz, bilinear in fields phi, with derivatives, and we immediately see that these are the only primary operators. The only primary operators correspond to traceless symmetric fields, traceless symmetric tensors. we can, instead of contracting it with the traceless symmetric tensors, we can leave free indices. Just consider this combination of derivatives and subtract the traces. Now, besides being primary operator that is annihilated by this special conformal transformation, it turns out that this is conserved current. And one can very easily see that this is a conserved current. Because this J is, in fact, the primary tensor, and the dimension is S plus D minus 2. It's convenient to talk about twist, which is spin minus dimension minus spin. So twist is D minus 2. So it has this transformation characteristic of the primary tensor. But then one can see on from general formula, from this formula, that if you take the divergence of this current, it will again be primary tensor. But we have already said that all the primary, it will be in fact the primary tensor of twist D instead of D minus 2. But we told I told that all the bilinears, all the bilinear primaries have twist D minus 2, so this is bound to be zero. Now we have this infinite series of high spin operators, primary operators, which are also conserved currents. And of course, because they are conserved currents, they generate symmetries. And in order to generate symmetry from this high spin operator, we need a conformal Killing tensor, which is a tensor, which such a tensor on the boundary that its symmetrized derivatives are proportional to the metric tensor. Then because J is traceless, if we contract it with, if we contract J with Xi with the conformal Killing vector tensor, then there will be one free index, and divergence with respect to this index will vanish because, obviously, because this is proportional to G and J is traceless. So this means that there are at least as many symmetries in this theory as there are conformal Killing tensors, and we just contract it with J, and this would generate the symmetry. In fact, there is a converse statement that any symmetry of the theory will be associated to this conformal Killing tensor, because if you consider this high derivative symmetry, you can see that from the fact that it preserves the Laplace equation, that the symbol should be the highest derivative piece should have conformal Killing tensor here. So we found this infinitely many symmetries corresponding to conformal Killing tensors. And these symmetries do not commute among each other, but they form an infinite dimensional non-abelian algebra. And now I want to explain what is this algebra in abstract terms, what is the structure of this algebra. So we'll use some kind of trick. Suppose that we act on phi by the differential operator, which is polynomial in x and d over dx. Then, since it preserves our action, it's a symmetry of the action, so it preserves the Laplace equation, which is our equation of motion. Consider some special solution of Laplace equation parameterized by pair of spinners, q and q bar. Q times q bar is a light-like vector, so this exponential is the solution of the Laplace equation. Let us act by this symmetry on this solution. We act with the polynomial differential operator on this exponential, qq bar x. And what we get is obviously some polynomials of x and qq bar times exponential. It's obviously some polynomial. Now, because our operator preserved the Laplacian, this would be also a harmonic function. Now, one can prove, it's not very hard, that if expression of the form polynomial times exponential is the solution of the Laplace equation, then it can be represented as some polynomials of q, q bar, and the derivatives of q and q bar acting on exponential. On one side, it's obvious that, in one direction, that if you take such expression and act on it by Laplace, then it's obvious Laplace will be zero because Laplace commutes with this polynomial. But on the other side, it's also true that if one can prove with little effort that polynomials times exponential is Laplacian zero, then there exists such P twiddle. And in fact, one can see that there is a one-to-one correspondence between differential operators L, which preserve delta phi equals zero, and the polynomials. But except for this polynomial, should be U1 invariant. There are as many, there should be as many Qs as Q bars. So U1 just rotates Q. And this trick allows us to express, to describe very simply, in very simple terms, the algebra of symmetries. So let us consider.
Can I just make sure you understand that formula? So on the left, you have some polynomial. The Qs are just constant spinners.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So you have some polynomial in x times the exponential. Mm-hmm. You're saying you can write that as some constant times the same exponential.
No, well, constant, but here a derivative.
Oh, there's a derivative.
Yeah, it's kind of. So, if you consider any operator in the free theory which is linear in the free fields, and such operators are in a representation of our high spin symmetries, because high spin symmetries act on phi, so they act on operators, obviously. Now, given such operator, so operators depend on the function f of x. We consider the operator, and also we consider kind of Fourier transform of this function. We could take phi with f with compact support if you want to avoid problems with divergences. So let us integrate this f against our special solution of the Laplace equation. And so there is a correspondence between functions of q bar and the operators. In particular, if f is delta function, you get phi of 0 here, or the local insertion. And on the other side, you have constant function of q and q bar. And to local derivatives of phi, we would have correspond the finite polynomials of q and q bar. And of course, one can see that the action of L of the symmetry on this operator would be the same as the action of our polynomial on this function of q and q bar. So this suggests that the algebra of symmetries is in fact the algebra of oscillators, because we have here oscillators q and d over dq. The algebra of such polynomials, the algebra of such differential operators is some kind of oscillator algebra. And we act, there is a kind of Heisenberg representation of the oscillators. And so that's the structure. Let me. Yeah, so to be precise, we can consider the algebra of oscillators consisting of four coordinates and four momenta. And also suppose that on the space of oscillators there is a complex structure, operator with square minus one, such that the commutation relations are invariant under the action of complex structure, and Keller metric has signature for pluses and for minus. Such spaces of oscillators are useful for oscillator realization of SU2, 2, the conformal algebra. Because all the quadratic Hamiltonians in these oscillators would form symplectic algebra. But those which are invariant under the complex structure will form SU2, actually U2. But we can factorize over the center and get SU2. So this is called oscillator representation of unitary algebra. Using this oscillator representation, one can introduce the infinite dimensional extension of the unitary algebra. We denote theta the oscillators from this space of oscillators. And so we consider expression of this form, where all alphas are real coefficients. So this algebra is called the higher spin algebra, and this is in fact the algebra of symmetries of the free complex scalar field. Since our Keller metric has structure for pluses for minuses, we could introduce the complex holomorphic oscillators actually. And then we reproduce one half of this oscillator as operator of multiplication by Q, and the other half by operation of differentiation with respect to Q. So in this way, we see that our algebra acts on functions of Q and Q bar, which are invariant under U1. And this is precisely the symmetries which we So this, according to this table, this functions of Q and Q bar are in relation with operators which are linear in free field. And I just explained how the algebra of these oscillators act according to Fock representation of the space of functions of Q and Q bar. And this is the algebra of higher spin symmetries, and this is the action of higher spin symmetries on the linear operators. Now, since we have such a big algebra of symmetries, we can ask how much this algebra constrains the correlation functions. And by the way, I should say that F is called the Doubleton representation. So originally, the Doubleton representation was invented for as a representation of SU2, 2. It is this oscillator representation. But now we see that it naturally extends to the representation of infinite dimensional algebra. So we consider the correlation functions of operators which are bilinear in free fields. So they are linear in phi and linear in phi star, which means that the operator belongs to the tensor product of the Doubleton representation and its complex conjugate. But in fact, there is a scalar product between this, so it's really such an operator can be considered as the operator in nth power of the Doubleton representation, which is invariant under the higher spin algebra. So the the correlation function, which is an endpoint correlation function, is the element of nth tensor product of F Doubleton times conjugate Doubleton. And it is the same as high spin invariant operator in nth power of Doubleton representation. But it turns out that, in fact, the arbitrary operator in the Doubleton representation can be represented as a linear combination, perhaps infinite linear combination, of generators of the high spin algebra. And therefore, the any high spin invariant operator in F tensor N should be, in fact, should commute with any linear operator in F. And this means that the only such operator is, in fact, the permutation. This very strongly constrains the correlation function, because essentially what it tells us that if we consider the endpoint correlation functions of, suppose we are not saying that this is in free theory, but we are saying that it has the same algebra of symmetries, and the algebra of symmetries acts on phi and phi star the same way as it acts on standard free fields. Then from this argument, we see that the only thing which is not determined by the higher spin word identities would be the which phi contracts with which phi star. So it's only finite. It definitely would be a rational function of x and y, and also there would be only a finite number of coefficients which are undetermined. In other words, the higher spin symmetries very strongly constrained the correlation functions. And this tells us that if we guess some theory in the bulk of ADS which has the same field content as bilinears in free fields, and which has global symmetry which acts on the bilinears in free fields in the same way as oscillator algebra acts on the tensor product of two Doubletons, then it's more or less guaranteed that this theory in the bulk will reproduce the right correlation functions on the boundary, more or less automatically. Um, This should be related somehow to the structure of poles of the correlation functions. This is some finite choice, and I think that, well, in each order n, there are n factorial coefficients. But already you see that the correlation functions will be rational functions of the positions of the operators. Yes, it can potentially depend on the permutation. It's something like how you contract color indices on phis. Not color, but the. It's something like putting indices on phi and saying how you can contract. If we contract, well, if we don't sum over all the contractions, but only consider one particular choice, then this correlation function will still be invariant, will still satisfy the highest spin-work identities. Mm.
If you just consider
one particular contraction, yes. No, don't sum over all contractions, but consider one particular contraction between phi and phi star, then it will still satisfy the highest spin algebra. It will still be invariant. Just as for conformal invariance, you didn't have to consider to sum over all permutations.
Right.
The highest spin symmetries are the same. They don't.
But there is other symmetry.
Yes, they will be other symmetries. Mm-hmm. But under already very broad assumptions that the field content is the same as the tensor product of two doubletons, already follows that the correlation functions will be of this rational form. And this coefficient should, this finite coefficient should be obvious from other symmetries of the theory. If you write down the particular theory, they should be obvious. So what this has to do with higher spin fields?
Like this on the other correlation functions of
operators. Right. Yeah, I think there are.
They have to be terminal,
yes, I would say yes. Again, modulo some finite number of.
Makes sense.
Because it's free, so, well, it has the same,
because
yeah.
Symmetry is really just tiny.
Yeah. But so remember the primary operators in the scalar field. So the logic was we truncated Young Mills only to bilinears of scalars. We considered only bilinears of scalars. And in that sector, the only primary operators were corresponded to symmetric tensor, traceless symmetric tensor. And this suggests that we should consider something traceless symmetric in the bulk of ideas. And we consider the high spin fields, which were introduced, by the way, by Fronsdal long ago. And they are described by fields, by tensor fields in ideas space, which are symmetric in their indices and double traceless, with these gauge transformations. Because we consider the gauge transformations with traceless parameter of gauge transformation, and here should be symmetrization over all the indices. So just one traceless would not be invariant under this. And I guess if you don't impose any tracelesses at all, then perhaps you wouldn't be able to write action, I would guess. What? Yeah. Kind of irreducibility, right? So free equations of motion you can write free equations of motion which are invariant under the symmetry, under the gauge transformation, but only in flat space or ADS space. In general curved manifold, it is impossible to write such an equation with covariant derivatives which would be invariant under this gauge transformation. So special symmetric properties of ADS are important for writing this. And this is in agreement with the fact that we expect high spin theories to contain high spin fields. It would not be possible to couple consistently only to gravity. So if we couple to gravity already, we have to consider also interactions with other fields. So there are a number of useful gauges for these equations of motion. The De Donder gauge is kind of a generalization of De Donder gauge and gravity. And it includes divergence and the trace. It turns out that for particular H, we satisfy the equation of motion. You can introduce stronger gauge. You can make such H simultaneously divergenceless and traceless. And this is useful for understanding the relation to the boundary.
So let's see. Simplest of these fields is S equals 4.
S equals 3 already.
So what is this? So there is just a symmetric rank 3?
Yes. Uh-huh.
What's the traceless condition?
No traceless condition, no. But the gauge transformation should be traceless, the gauge parameters.
I mean, does this agree with the standard higher spin field equations in flat space?
Well, except for mass term, you have to throw away the mass term. But I'm not sure what you call standard, because if you want some equation which starts with Laplacian and then you add something for gauge invariance, these terms which you add are uniquely determined. So these equations are essentially unique. And in flat space, everything, I guess, is the same, except for you don't need the mass term. The mass term is needed when you commute covariant derivatives to make a gauge invariant.
Sorry, that term doesn't vanish in flat space.
Oh, well, there is R somewhere to make, there is R if you reproduce R. R in front of all nablas, R square. So when R goes to infinity, this is neglected.
Dimensionally.
Yeah. So related to the primary fields on the boundary, we need boundary to bulk propagator. And remember the primaries were, the primaries were traceless symmetric tensors. So we consider this our current J, which we constructed and then multiplied by traceless symmetric tensor, we integrated over the four-dimensional space. And then this is the arbitrary deformation of the action can be represented in this form, because all the operators are either primaries or derivatives of primaries. So this is the most general form of the deformation of the boundary action. And now we are looking for the solution of the free high spin equations in the bulk, which has the prescribed boundary properties, given this V. And the prescribed boundary properties are that we represent the metric in this form, regulator times. This is a metric of ADS, this is finite metric, so this conformal factor. And we take 1 over R square H and think of it as a tensor vector field, tensor product of S vectors, and then each vector you can just restrict on the boundary, because vector can be naturally restricted to the boundary. So the boundary condition is this. It is not very obvious that the restriction on the boundary is traceless, But this happens to be the case in that gauge we considered, in that special gauge when H is both divergenceless and traceless. From divergenceless of H follows that the ZZ component in Poincaré coordinates vanishes near the boundary faster than the component with all the indices tangent to the boundary. And then from the tracelessness condition follows that this leading component should be traceless. So the restriction of the solution in the special gauge to the boundary in this sense should be traceless symmetric tensor on the boundary. This is in one direction. And in the other direction, we need boundary to bulk propagator, which is quite easy to find, of course. And in the Poincaré coordinates, it has this form. So it's propagator from the point z equals 0 on the boundary from to the point z, z naught in the bulk. And it has very nice form in the picture with hyperboloid embedded in flat space, but I won't write it in Poincaré coordinates because it's just simpler to explain. So the solution is that if you take V on the boundary, trace the symmetric tensor, then we contract it with this propagator, integrate over the whole Minkowski space, and get the solution which has the boundary condition, which has the boundary behavior which I specified. And this is some awful normalization factor which I computed. This operators, bilinear primaries on the boundary, they generated conserved currents. They were conserved current on the boundary and generated symmetries. And the relation between symmetries, global symmetries on the boundary, and gauge symmetries in the bulk are encoded in this identity. So remember, on the boundary, the currents were divergenceless. The divergence was zero. But if you consider this boundary to bulk propagator, if you explicitly take the divergence with respect to one of its indices, we will see that it's not exactly zero, but it's a gauge transformation with some particular gauge parameter, which is singular near the boundary. So this formula tells us that there is a relation, actually, between the conformal Killing vectors, conformal Killing tensors in the boundary and traceless Killing tensors in the bulk. If you take psi to be conformal Killing tensors, then we know this is zero because J is traceless. Then if you consider the integral psi against this special gauge parameter lambda, then we will see that nabla mu of this will be symmetrized, will be zero, just because integration by parts. Nabla mu of lambda would be d over dxi, then we integrate by parts, and this is zero. So this means that given the traceless Killing tensor in the bulk, this formula gives us the corresponding traceless Killing tensor on the bulk, from the boundary to the bulk. And So the traceless Killing tensors in the bulk are the global gauge transformations. Because the homogeneous term in the gauge transformations, because free highest spin theory is invariant under this inhomogeneous gauge transformation, under this free gauge transformation. But if we introduce already triple interactions, then in fact, if we have three-point functions correctly reproduced, then we should make sure that the triple interaction is gauge invariant on shell, because only then we can have that this correlation function is zero, that GI is zero. For this, we need the triple interaction is gauge invariant on shell. But it cannot possibly correct that the triple interaction is gauge invariant of shell. In fact, the current should have divergence proportional to contraction of proportional to the action of equation of motion on the external legs. And to compensate for that, we need to deform delta lambda so that the contribution of the divergence of the current proportional to equations of motion would cancel with something coming from the something coming from the variation of the free action. And so we have this object delta 1 now. Lambda is the coupling constant, 1 over n. And delta 1 is some compensating gauge transformation, which is now inhomogeneous and, in fact, linear in the highest fin field H. So I don't know what it is because I haven't solved the problem of interaction. But there are, of course, properties of this delta lambda 1 which are clear from general ground. First of all, if lambda is a Killing tensor, a traceless Killing tensor in the bulk, then this delta lambda should be a symmetry of at least free action and, in fact, triple interaction also, because for Killing tensors, for Killing tensors, delta lambda 0 is already 0, so delta lambda 1 should preserve the free action. And one can see on the general grounds, if we find such a triple interaction that it reproduces the three-point correlation functions, then the following identity should be true. As I said, for lambda being the Killing tensor, the variation of the solution of the free equation will be again solution of the free equation. Now, if we take solution corresponding to insertion of operator or on the boundary, then the variation would correspond to variation of this operator or with respect to the Killing tensor on the boundary, which is related to Killing tensor in the bulk by that integral transform which I written earlier. And this follows basically from the general properties of correlation functions, and it is more or less a straightforward generalization of what we have for spin 1 and 2 in the usual ADS safety correspondence. The significance of this formula is that what we see is that, suppose that we introduced interactions. And then without interactions, the free action was invariant under delta 0, which was just delta 0 h was nabla times h, nabla times lambda. Then to introduce interaction, we have to introduce compensating gauge transformation, which is now linear in h. It is like epsilon comma a term in the transformation for the gauge field. So this comes with coupling constant. Now, there is a possibility that there are other terms. But now let us consider the special case when lambda is a Killing tensor. Then suppose that for some reason it happens for Killing tensor that this is zero. And then if the three-point functions are correctly reproduced, then this delta lambda 1 would act as the corresponding global transformation acts on the boundary, which means that the action of high spin symmetries in the bulk would act in the same way as high spin symmetries act on the boundary. So the conclusion is that if you find several with these properties, the three-point functions correctly reproduce the high spin gauge transformations in the bulk, and for Killing tensor, the higher corrections to gauge transformation vanish, and only the global rotation remains. Then the boundary S matrix has the same symmetries as the correlation functions of the free theory. And so since the symmetries restrict correlation functions, the boundary S matrix should give the correlation function of the free theory. So that's why it's important to find the theory with the right symmetries. This is basically what I wanted to say because I'm not ready to discuss Vasilyev's solution.
His solution presumably is the theory of the symmetry.
Yes, it explicitly has the symmetries, yes.
And the gauge transformation is just terminate?
I think that it terminates, although we had discussion with Vasilyev about it. I think that it terminates because, in my opinion, yeah, in my opinion, for killing, it just becomes a global rotation.
Just a comment. I still find it hard to see why one expects to find the local Hairspin theory in the Vulcan. I still have this feeling that we should be thinking about a string theory with a strongly coupled world sheet theory. I mean, that's the naive limit. That is, it's a string theory in the Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
And the world sheet theory is strongly coupled, and the question is, how do you make sense of that? And I mean, it seems to me what I take away from all this is that there are all these symmetries in the theory. And that if there really is a strongly coupled world sheet theory, then there's a lot of information that hasn't been used to try to construct this theory, namely all the symmetries.
So,
you know, I mean, there may be some part of this which has application to a different way to attack the problem.
Well, even supersymmetry is not.
Well, you're not using supersymmetry.
No,
yes, but I'm saying that in the world sheet formalism, the symmetries may be not very obvious. The target space symmetries might be not very
obvious. Yeah, it's not clear how this kind of symmetry carries over to the world sheet, but it should be there in some form.
Right, I agree, yeah. Well, roughly speaking, it's just that you would see this vertex separators corresponding to this massless high space fields.
Yeah, you say that's basically what it is, that you have these.
Yes, this is one-to-one, yeah.
What you have one?
The vertices corresponding to high spin fields, massless high spin fields. You should see them as.
You still have the vertex operators.
Yes.
Yeah. And they have some kind of definite operator products with the other fields from the algebra.
Yes, this was already,
Any more questions? Thanks, Andrea.